Good afternoon, brethren. Hope you all are doing well. Now, we've all just kept the Days of Unleavened Bread for the past week. We're on that seventh and last day. Now, we do this every year, and we're reminded of God's plan for all mankind. And today, I want to look at events that occurred on the last Day of Unleavened Bread and consider what lessons they represented for Israel, and also consider what spiritual lessons we should be learning from them as well, because God told us to remember these things. The first event that I want to look at today has to do with Israel leaving Egypt. And I know we look at this every year, but it is useful for us to review, and I think it's important for us to remember the important lessons that God was laying out. He doesn't want us to forget those things. First of all, I want us to consider the condition that Israel was in when God decided to work with them. You know, they were slaves in Egypt. They understood that they were a people separate from Egypt because the Egyptians made that very clear. But it does not appear that they had a real relationship with God. They had an oral tradition that they'd passed down about Abraham, Isaac, Joseph, Jacob. You know, but from their perspective, they were slaves in a land that was home to them. They only knew the land of Egypt. They didn't know any other land. They didn't know the promised land. That was 400 years earlier, over 400 years earlier, I think. They also probably had a polytheistic outlook. They lived in Egypt and would have been completely surrounded by the concept of many gods representing many different things. Pharaoh himself in Egypt was considered a god, and Israel really wouldn't have been in a position to push back against that too much as slaves. They more than likely considered the gods of Egypt to be more powerful than the god of their ancestors because they were slaves. They were oppressed, but they really didn't seem to have a lot of enthusiasm for deliverance when Moses showed up on the scene. You know, they basically told Moses, hey, go away, you're going to make things worse. It seems as if they pretty much questioned that deliverance was even really possible. Now, it's interesting that God, he poured out 10 plagues on Egypt, and he was demonstrating his power to this people who didn't really know him. And the 10 plagues that he poured out, you know, if you look at them carefully, he was demonstrating his power over the various important gods of Egypt, starting with the Nile and ending with the sun and the god of death and life. So as the plagues are poured out and the people see these amazing miracles, they're really just starting to learn or believe in the power of the real God. Now, with that in mind, let's turn to Exodus 12. We're going to pick up the story there. Exodus chapter 12, we're going to start in verse 21. Starting in verse 21. We'll read down to verse 28. It says, then Moses called for all the elders of Israel and said to them, pick out and take lambs for yourself according to your families, and kill the Passover lamb. And you shall take a bunch of hyssop, dip it in the blood that is in the basin, and strike the lintel of the two doorposts with the blood that is in the basin. And none of you shall go out of the door of his house until morning, for the Lord will pass through to strike the Egyptians. And when he sees the blood on the lintel and on the two doorposts, the Lord will pass over the door and not allow the destroyer to come into your houses to strike you. And you shall observe this thing as an ordinance for you and your sons forever. It shall come to pass when you come to the land which the Lord will give you, just as he promised, that you shall keep this service. And it shall be when your children say to you, why, what do you mean by this service? That you shall say, it is a Passover sacrifice to the Lord who passed over the houses of the children of Israel in Egypt when he struck the Egyptians and delivered our households. So the people bowed their heads and worshiped. Then the children of Israel went away and did so, just as the Lord had commanded Moses and Aaron, so they did. You know, by the time we get to this 10th plague, Israel seems to accept that God will do what Moses says that God will do. And they seem to obey the Passover. We don't read examples that the Israelites didn't obey it. It seems like they all obeyed it at this point. If we read down, continuing on in verse 29, it says, "And it came to pass at midnight that the Lord struck the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on his throne to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborns of livestock. So Pharaoh rose that night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where there was not one dead. Then he called for Moses and Aaron by night and said, 'Rise and go out from among my people, both you and the children of Israel, and go serve the Lord as you have said. Also take your flocks and your herds as you have said, and be gone and bless me also.' And the Egyptians urged the people that they might send them out of the land in haste, for they said, 'We shall all be dead.'" You know, of course, God did exactly what he said he would do. And that was the final thing that broke Pharaoh. You know, the 10th plague, the death of the firstborn. At least temporarily, it broke Pharaoh. And he commands Israel to leave, and he even requests that they bless him. You know, at this point, the whole country, both the Egyptians and the Israelites, acknowledge the power of God. It was clear to everybody who was involved that this God was dealing specifically for Israel and against the Egyptians. If we continue on in verse 34, it says, "So the people took their dough before it was leavened, having their kneading bowls bound up in their clothes on their shoulders. Now the children of Israel had done according to the word of Moses, and they had asked from the Egyptians articles of silver, articles of gold, and clothing. And the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so that they granted them what they requested. Thus they plundered the Egyptians. Then the children of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot, besides children. A mixed multitude went with them, and flocks and herds, a great deal of livestock. And they baked unleavened cakes of the dough which they had brought out of Egypt, for it was not leavened, because they were driven out of Egypt and could not wait, nor had they prepared provisions for themselves. Now the sojourn of the children of Israel who lived in Egypt was 430 years, and it came to pass at the end of the 430 years, on that very same day, it came to pass that all the armies of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. It is a night of solemn observance to the Lord for bringing them out of the land of Egypt. This is the night of the Lord, a solemn observance for all the children of Israel throughout their generations." So after the evening in which Passover occurred, then the Israelites plundered the Egyptians, and they come together as a nation. You know, for the first time, they were able to come together as a nation. They hadn't before that. They were slaves. The Egyptians certainly did not want them coming together in one mass. That was very dangerous. You don't do that with slaves. You keep them as separate as possible. But they came together as a nation. And we read that there were 600,000 men. You know, some people estimate that's probably about 2 million people that would have been coming out at that time. And these people would have been spread, 2 million people would have been spread over the whole region of Goshen. So it's believed that during the day portion after the Passover, they would have been coming together at Ramses and then traveling to Succoth. Now, we don't know where Succoth was. The word Succoth, if you recognize it from Feast of Tabernacles, it basically means camp. So, you know, it seems to have been just a place that they set up camp. But they got there by the night right before the first day of unleavened bread. Let's turn over to Exodus chapter 13. We're going to drop down to verse 17. And it says, "Then it came to pass, when Pharaoh had let the people go, that God did not lead them by the way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near. For God said, 'Lest perhaps the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt.' So God led the people around by the way of the wilderness of the Red Sea, and the children of Israel went up in orderly ranks out of the land of Egypt." Let's drop down to verse 20. It says, "So they took their journey from Succoth and camped in Etham at the edge of the wilderness. And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, so as to go by day and night. He did not take away the pillar of the cloud by day or the pillar of fire by night from before the people. You know, now after camping at Succoth, the Israelites go to Etham, which again, we don't really know where that was, but it says that it was on the edge of the wilderness. And it's interesting, the scripture tells us that God decided the exact path that Israel was going to take. He didn't leave it up to them. He didn't leave it up to Moses. You know, he put a sign that they could not miss, a cloud in the sky, and then at night, a pillar of fire. That pillar of fire, in my opinion, would have been, you know, that would have been the icing on the cake of, hey, that definitely isn't normal. Never saw one of those before. You know, but God also doesn't take Israel along the path that would be anticipated. And I find that in itself interesting. You know, I've found, I don't know about you, but I've found in my life, a lot of times I can get to the point where I almost put God into a box and think, you know, God has to do things a certain way. He has to do it this way or that way, because that seems like that would be the best way to me. And it's amazing how many times God does things in a totally unexpected way. You know, in this particular case, we'll see that God's unexpected way caught not only the Israelites by surprise, but it also caught the Egyptians by surprise. But I want to point out that God isn't done with performing miracles either. You know, not only is there the miracle of the cloud and the pillar of fire, you know, large groups of people don't normally move very quickly. They just don't. And 2 million people? Even if it was only 600,000, that's a large group of people. That isn't going to move very quickly. But God did something that I hadn't really noticed too much before. You know, I noticed the cloud and the fire. But God is doing that, it says, specifically because he had Israel travel by day and by night. You know, they're not stopping for whatever period of time that was. We don't know how many days he did that. But it seems like it was a couple days where he had them travel by day and by night. Now, we just kept the holy days, and I'm not sure about you, but I stayed up late, like past 10 o'clock. And I was feeling that for several days afterwards. We don't do well without sleep. People just don't do well without sleep. And Israel isn't just young. This is a nation that isn't just young men and women. You know, it's old people and children as well. Now just think about a bunch of young kids, little kids, babies, or elderly, going a couple days without sleep and traveling. They're not just like going a couple days without sleep. They're walking the entire time. And yet, that seems to be exactly what God did for Israel. He had to have poured out the energy and ability to do that, just to keep going. And I guess to me, it struck me this year. I was like, wow, that was a miracle in and of itself. Let's drop down to chapter 14. It says, "Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'Speak to the children of Israel that they turn and camp before Pi-Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, opposite Baal Zephon. You shall camp before it by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, they are bewildered by the land. The wilderness has closed them in. Then I will harden Pharaoh's heart so that he will pursue them. And I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army. And the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord.' And they did so." You know, we're told, again, more interesting things. God is speaking directly to Moses here, and he lets Moses know that he intends to have Israel turn and camp in a very specific place. And God has a purpose for what he's doing. But to most of Israel, who God didn't speak directly to, and they're just blindly following this cloud and fire, they're not aware of the purpose that God has in doing this. all they're going to see is that they are moving into what appears to be a trap. If we continue on in verse 5, it says, "So now it was told the king of Egypt that the people had fled, and the heart of Pharaoh and his servants was turned against the people, and they said, 'Why have we done this, that we have let Israel go from serving us?' So he made ready his chariots and took his people with him. Also he took 600 choice chariots and all the chariots of Egypt with captains over every one of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the children of Israel, and the children of Israel went out with boldness. So when the Egyptians pursued them, all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army, and overtook them camping by the sea beside Pi-Hahiroth before Baal-Zephon." We're told that Pharaoh has this change of heart. He sends his army out to bring Israel back. And it appears that God's choice of travel path played a role in Pharaoh's decision. You know, from his perspective, this mass of people is wandering aimlessly in a wilderness. It's clearly lost and hopeless. You know, he might have even thought, "Hey, I'm going to do them a favor. They're all going to die out there. I'm going to bring them back so that they can serve us again." Doesn't tell us that exactly. But it seems like his purpose is to bring them back to be servants again, slaves again. You know, God doesn't seem so powerful to Pharaoh anymore when he's leading the people through a wilderness. And when Pharaoh finally does catch up to the Israelites, he's even more convinced because they've set up camp in an area where they're boxed in and vulnerable. It's like the perfect situation in his mind. He's like, they couldn't have done this any better. They can't escape from the sides. I can catch them all at once. Let's drop down to verse 10. It says, "And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. Then they said to Moses, 'Because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, "Let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians"? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness." You know, these thoughts didn't go away. That's what was truly at the heart of a lot of the people. They had seen all the miracles. They'd seen everything. And yet, now that they, again, are in a very vulnerable position, and they are in a very vulnerable position, they're terrified and they say, "We didn't want any of this." And Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see again no more forever. And the Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace." And that leads us to what is traditionally considered to be the seventh day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. You know, Israel, at this point, has looked at their circumstances, concluded that God no longer has the power to deliver them because things weren't going the way that they imagined it would go. Moses tells them that this is all part of God's plan of salvation. But I want you to think about something for a little bit. You know, Israel had left Egypt. They were out of Egypt. And Egypt was in bad shape after the 10 plagues. But Egypt still had an army, and it still had a mental hold over these people. You can see that here. But God was going to do something that would change all that. If we drop down to verse 19, it says, "Then the angel of God who went before the camp of Israel moved and went behind them, and the pillar of cloud went from before them and stood before them. So it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel. Thus it was a cloud and darkness to the one, and it gave light by night to the other, so that the one did not come near the other all that night." Now, so just as the Egyptians catch up to Israel, it's turning night, And God miraculously, again, separates the Egyptians from Israel with a cloud, with the very cloud that was leading Israel. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night and made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. So the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on the dry land, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. So I think this is the classic picture that we think of, the strong wind coming, the waters parting, and Israel passing through the sea, walking right through there. Let's drop back to verse 15. God tells them what they were going to do. And the Lord said to Moses, "Why do you cry to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward." Now, forward meant going into the middle of that sea. Now, God had just performed a miracle to make that possible. God made everything possible for them. Verse 23 again. And the Egyptians pursued and went after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. You know, it doesn't tell us exactly when, but at some point, as the Israelites are going across the sea, the Egyptians figure it out, and they give chase. They start to go through the sea themselves. Now it came to pass in the morning watch that the Lord looked down upon the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and the cloud, and he troubled the army of the Egyptians, and he took off their chariot wheels so that they drove them with difficulty. And the Egyptians said, "Let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea, that the waters may come back upon the Egyptians, on their chariots and on their horsemen." And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and when the morning appeared, the sea returned to its full depth while the Egyptians were fleeing into it. So the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. Then the waters returned and covered the chariots, the horsemen, and all the army of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. Not so much as one of them remained. But the children of Israel had walked on dry land in the midst of the sea, and the waters were a wall to them on the right hand and on the left. So the Lord saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians. And Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Thus Israel saw the great work which the Lord had done in Egypt. So the people feared the Lord and believed the Lord and his servant Moses. You know, by the morning, the Egyptians are caught in the sea while the waters return and drown the entire army. And the scripture tells us that Israel believed and feared God at this point. You know, this was the point where the Egyptians no longer had a hold on the minds of Israel anymore. They saw them dead. God saved them from their oppressors that day and provided true deliverance. They were no longer afraid of Egypt. Unfortunately, we know the rest of the story, and that belief didn't last forever. But I want to point out that God had a plan all along for this salvation. The whole trip that they took led up to this seventh day, to the miracle that occurred on the seventh day. It started with taking the path that seemed totally illogical to take, and it ended with Israel having to believe God and move forward on another path that logically shouldn't have existed through the middle of the sea, while their enemies were destroyed in that same sea. You know, that's not the only miracle that the Bible records to us that seems to have occurred on the last day of unleavened bread. There's another one that has some eerie similarities to it. Let's turn over to Joshua chapter 5. Joshua chapter 5 and verse 1. It says, "So it was when all the kings of the Amorites who were on the west side of the Jordan and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan from before the children of Israel until we had crossed over, that the heart melted and there was no spirit in them any longer because of the children of Israel." So we're we're breaking into the story here of Israel finally entering the promised land. And God performed another miracle, almost like the one that he performed on the seventh day. He parted the sea or stopped the waters of the Jordan so Israel could cross. You know, the Canaanites thought that they were at least safe during the spring period because the Jordan floods and nobody could get across it. They were convinced of that. And God performed a miracle that stopped that. And I'm sure Israel was very aware of their history. They would have remembered that. But let's drop down to verse 8. It says, "So it was, when they had finished circumcising all the people, that they stayed in their places in the camp till they were healed. Then the Lord said to Joshua, 'This day I have rolled away from you the reproach of Egypt from you.' Therefore the name of the place is called Gilgal to this day. So the children of Israel camped in Gilgal and kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month at twilight on the plains of Jericho. And they ate the produce of the land on the day after the Passover, unleavened bread and parched grain on the very same day." You know, so the scripture tells us that this is right at the Passover. They've crossed over, they've circumcised all the people because they hadn't been circumcised before. And now they keep the Passover. If we drop down to verse 1 of chapter 6, it says, "Now Jericho was securely shut up because of the children of Israel. None went out and none came in." There's a big obstacle that they have in front of them now, the well-fortified city of Jericho. Now we have, digs have occurred there, and they found that Jericho had two wall systems around the system. It was an embankment wall system. The first was a 12 to 15 foot high retaining wall around pretty much the whole city. And then on top of that retaining wall was a 6 foot thick, 20 to 26 foot high mud brick wall. So that was the first wall. And then there was an embankment. So they filled the area behind that with soil and it sloped up another 20 feet in height. And at the top of that embankment, there was a second wall that was 20 to 25 feet high and 6 feet thick. Again, a mud brick wall. And they found that people did indeed build houses and live in that embankment area between the two walls. And the city had a spring that provided water. And they found burnt grain in the city, so it was well prepared for a siege. The city of Jericho was prepared to hold out for a very long period and would have seemed like an insurmountable obstacle to entering the land. It was right before them, right before everything that God had promised them. But God saw this differently. If we read in verse 2 of chapter 6, it says, "And the Lord said to Joshua, 'See, I have given Jericho into your hand, its king and its mighty men of valor. You shall march around the city, all your men of war. You shall go around the city once. This you shall do 6 days. And the seven priests shall bear seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. But the seventh day you shall march around the city 7 times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. Then it shall come to pass, when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, and when you hear the sound of the trumpet, that all the people shall shout with a great shout. Then the wall of the city will fall down flat, and the people will go up, every man straight before him." So God gives Joshua the battle plan. And the plan doesn't really seem to make a whole lot of logical sense to people. Marching around a city in and of itself would seem to have no impact on impressive fortifications. Would seem to. Let's read. Drop down to verse 10. It says, "Now Joshua had commanded the people, saying, 'You shall not shout or make any noise with your voice, nor shall any word proceed out of your mouth until the day I say to you, shout. Then you shall shout.' So he had the ark of the Lord circle the city, going around it once. Then they came into the camp and lodged in the camp. And Joshua rose early in the morning, and the priest took up the ark of the Lord. Then seven priests bearing seven trumpets of ram's horn before the ark of the Lord went on continually and blew with the trumpets, and the armed men went before them. But the rear guard came after the ark of the Lord, while the priests continued blowing the trumpets. And the second day they marched around the city once and returned to the camp. So they did for 6 days. You know, Joshua's following the plan. And for 6 days, the first 6 days of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, they march once around the city. And then that leads us to the seventh day. Start reading about that in verse 15. It says, "But it came to pass on the seventh day that they rose early, about the dawning of the day, and marched around the city 7 times in the same manner. On that day only they marched around the city 7 times. And the seventh time it was so, when the priests blew the trumpets, that Joshua said to the people, 'Shout, for the Lord has given you the city. Now the city shall be doomed by the Lord to destruction in it, and all who are in it. Only Rahab the harlot shall live, she and all who are with her in the house, because she hid the messengers that we sent. And you, by all means, keep yourselves from the accursed things, lest you become accursed when you take of the accursed things, and make the camp of Israel a curse and trouble it. But all the silver and gold and the vessels of bronze and iron are consecrated to the Lord and shall come into the treasury of the Lord.'" Now, when we get to the seventh day, Joshua provides a few more instructions from God. You know, first, in all their other marching around, they were supposed to keep quiet, other than the trumpets. Today, they were supposed to shout. Second, they were to preserve Rahab and her family. And third, they were not to take any spoil from the city for themselves. Everything alive was to be utterly destroyed, and only the valuable metals were to be consecrated to God and placed in the treasury of the Lord. You know, those were the instructions. If we continue on in verse 20, it says, "So the people shouted when the priests blew the trumpets, and it happened when the people heard the sound of the trumpet, and the people shouted with a great shout, that the wall fell down flat. Then the people went up into the city, every man straight before him, and they took the city. And they utterly destroyed all that was in the city, both man and woman, young and old, ox and sheep and donkey, with the edge of the sword. But Joshua had said to the two men who had spied out the land, 'Go into the harlot's house. From there bring out this woman and all she has, as you have sworn to her.' And the young men who had been spies went in and brought out Rahab, her father, her mother, her brothers, and all that she had. So they brought them out, her relatives, and left them outside the camp of Israel. But they burned the city and all that was in it with fire. Only the silver and gold and vessels of bronze and iron they put into the treasury of the house of the Lord. And Joshua spared Rahab the harlot, her father's household, and all she had. So she dwells in Israel to this day, because she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy from the land of Jericho." And the scripture tells us that, again, God fulfilled his word perfectly. It's interesting, when they dug up this area, they see that the wall portion that was above the retaining wall seems to have fallen in, or, you know, out of the city, and created a ramp of bricks right up into the city. So when it says that the men went up into the city, they literally were going up the bricks that were the wall into the city. And they found that one portion of the wall on the north side did not fall, which again would confirm that at least one portion remained where Rahab's house was. And again, they did find that the city had been burned. And they found many, many storage jars filled with grain, which was unusual because grain was a valuable commodity. And it normally would have been taken by conquerors. But it makes perfect sense because Israel was under a curse from taking any of the spoil. And although the scripture doesn't specifically state this, it appears that Israel did not take any casualties in this battle. And I say that because if you read the next chapter, they take 36 casualties, and that seems to have caused them great grief and their whole hearts to melt. So during this, they did not seem to have any casualties. So again, on the seventh day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, God performed another miracle. He turned the defenses of the city into pathways into the city. He caused it to fall and gave his people the strength to remove this seemingly immovable obstacle. So, brethren, I want to reflect on the lessons of these stories. Because God has called us to be his children. And Paul even refers to the saints as the Israel of God. And we are told that we have spiritual adversaries. And I can't help but think that those spiritual adversaries thought that they had Jesus Christ exactly where they wanted him when they had him crucified. He figuratively was between them, the mountains, and the sea. It's pretty obvious that they never saw the salvation that he was working out coming. Because that worked out their own destruction. That was his victory over those adversaries. They didn't see it until it already occurred. And those same adversaries can come after us, collectively or individually. Our whole spiritual lives can be compared to that journey out of Egypt. We've been promised a future that is even better than what Israel was promised. The path that we need to take needs to be the one where God leads us, where God's direction and word tells us to go, out of sin. And our journey is very likely to head down paths that we wouldn't choose for ourselves and may not even make sense to us at times. And in the end, we seek a salvation that only God can provide for us. You know, we can't win our own victory. Israel couldn't have won their own victory over Egypt. We can't win our own victory. We're dead men walking. Only God can provide that victory. But we need to move forward. We need to follow God's direction for our lives. And then, just like at Jericho, we face obstacles to entering God's promised land. We can face trials that seem insurmountable. We deal with internal roadblocks that really have to be removed for us to spiritually grow. We need to look at Jesus and the life that he lived. You know, Satan tempted Jesus with the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, and Jesus overcame all those temptations without sinning. Jesus dealt with betrayal from a close friend. Jesus dealt with the hypocrisy of leaders of the nation who should have been serving the Father and himself, but instead were focused on themselves. And Jesus dealt with unfairness on a level that none of us can ever compare our lives to. And yet, through it all, Jesus overcame every obstacle. And we need to remember that he and the Father are currently living in us and can truly flatten the walls to anything that we're dealing with. There is no trial so great that he can't help us overcome it. We still have to play our part. We have to obey God. We have to figuratively march around the walls. And when God removes those walls, we have to go in and put to death those parts of ourself that cause us to sin. But God is the one who does the heavy lifting. We just need to obey him. We need to seek him. We need to seek his will. And we need to walk in his ways. You know, I hope we remember these lessons and apply them today and going forth. I think it's useful that we remember these things every year. Because these days truly represent our physical lives as we journey to the spiritual promise of God.